Welcome to the Medical Journal of Australia podcast. The MJA is Australia's top peer-reviewed general medical journal, publishing groundbreaking research to the medical community since 1914. My name is Kate Swanell, and I am the MJA's news and online editor. Who doesn't love salt? Well, it turns out that most of us love it a little too much. Professor Bruce Neal is the Deputy Director of the George Institute for Global Health in Australia. He's the lead author of a systematic review of salt intake by Australians, which is published by the MJA on the 29th of January. And he is my special guest today. The World Health Organization recommends a maximum intake of 5 grams per day, and Australia has signed up to reduce the mean population salt intake by 30% by 2025. How are we doing with all of that?
So there's very little evidence to say how we're doing with all of that, unfortunately,
yeah.
Which is one of the reasons that this paper was done. Clearly, to understand how we're doing, we need to have some sort of baseline, and then we need to measure progress against it. Now, we don't really have a good national baseline, as a consequence, we set out with this project to try and sort of summarise what was out there to get an idea.
Yeah.
And then the idea would be that, in the future, we might repeat surveys of one form or another, perhaps informed by this work, to see how we're going. I guess the other way to view the question of how we're going is to say, not do we have any data to say that Australians are eating less salt, but what are the actions being taken by government, industry, community to reduce salt? And there again, it's pretty limited. There's limited data. I mean, we have showed that for a couple of food categories in the past, there has been some reduction in sodium levels. But more broadly, there is little evidence that industry or government have adopted targets or implemented actions, and much less evidence that any of those things have been acted upon.
Are we good at monitoring those programs?
So we've actually, through our Food Switch program, got pretty good data on the composition of packaged processed and restaurant foods from chain restaurants in Australia for the last number of years. What we haven't been very good at is systematically reporting on that, and that's been simply down to a sort of a capacity issue. We've managed to raise the resources to collect the data, but not to do as many analyses of it as we would like to.
Okay.
But that is something that we are currently rectifying.
So tell us about this systematic review that you've undertaken with a large group of authors. What did you look at, and what were your major findings?
So what we wanted to do was try and collect information about every survey of salt consumption that had been done in Australia, and to sort of summarise that in a quantitative way.
Right.
And we set out from the beginning to not just collect the sort of gold standard surveys, which would be, you know, nationally representative and done using 24-hour urine samples, but really to recognise that there just weren't going to be any of those. And so we'd take whatever we got, pull it all together and see what we could deduce from it. What we found was sort of what we expected, which was that the 24-hour urine samples, the surveys based on 24-hour urine samples gave us what we expected to see based upon what we know salt consumption levels are in other countries that have sort of similar lifestyles and behaviours around the world. What we also saw was that methods that were based on diet recall, so sort of non-direct measurements of salt excretion in the urine, gave substantial underestimates. And that's been pretty well documented in the past, so we expected to see it here.
Mm-hmm.
And the degree of underestimation is pretty substantial, so, you know, sort of a third to 50%. I think the other thing that was of value that we did was we also inflated our estimates from the 24-hour urine samples by about 10%, because we know from many other studies that about 10% of salt that is ingested is excreted through feces or sweat.
Right.
So to actually get a proper estimate, you do need to inflate it by about 10%. That's how we arrived at our estimate of about 10 grams a day for men and about 7 or 8 grams a day for women.
which is twice the recommendation.
Well, yeah, it is. Interestingly, we know that women consume less salt than men, and they almost certainly, should have a lower target than men because they eat less calories, they have smaller bodies. But we do have this universal sort of target of 5 grams per day, whether you're a man or a woman. I suspect that probably it ought to be 5 grams a day for men and actually 4 grams a day for women, if we were being logical about it.
Were you able to find a trend over the decades? Has our consumption changed much?
So we did look at that, and we did that by sort of meta-regressing the sort of study results in terms of their estimate of daily salt intake against the year that they were published in. We weren't able to find any evidence that salt intake was going up, but we weren't able to find any evidence that salt intake was going down. Important to note, however, that that's a pretty weak technique, particularly when you've got, studies done in many different ways over the years. So it doesn't provide you with great power to investigate that. The other thing, couple of characteristics we did look at in that same way was body mass index. And there we did find the association we expected, which was that people with higher body mass index typically consume more salt. And that's usually because they're eating more food. We didn't see an association with age. And actually often what you see is a slightly complicated association with age where salt intake particularly is lower among very young people. The main sort of peaks in young, middle age, particularly in men, and then starts to decline in adults. And again, that's primarily a function of how much food they eat.
Are salt reduction programs or campaigns, are they very expensive? I guess, and what I'm asking you is, are the benefits worth the cost?
So this is much debated. The epidemiology is difficult because it's mostly observational. And while we have really strong data linking increased salt consumption to blood pressure and decreased salt consumption to lower blood pressure from randomized trials, what we lack is a big outcome study that says we reduce salt and we reduce the risks of stroke, heart attack, vascular death, and the like. And furthermore, we have this observational epidemiology sort of associating salt intake levels with risks of death. And we have J-shaped associations. So if you eat a lot of salt, you're at high risk. But also if you eat very little salt, you're at high risk as well, with an idea somewhere in the middle. Yeah. And the problem there is that, it could be that that's real. So eating low salt is bad for you. In reality, it's probably not. What it probably is that people who eat low salt are eating low salt for a reason, often that they're sick. They've got high blood pressure, they've had a prior heart attack or something else.
Right.
And we see these J-shaped associations for all sorts of sort of risk factors. We see the same thing for smoking. People who don't smoke are at higher risk of dying of lung cancer than people who smoke a little bit. And that's not because not smoking causes lung cancer. It's because people got a bit of a cough because they used to smoke. They stopped smoking and... No. So whether these J-shaped associations with salt are real or not is a bone of much contention. And what you believe about the benefits of national salt reduction programs depends very much upon whether you believe the associations are linear or are J-shaped.
Right.
Personally, I think the evidence, if you look at the totality of it, is strongly in favour of protection from salt reduction programs implemented nationwide.
Yeah.
And you would expect to get really solid reductions in numbers of strokes and heart attacks for really very little investment. The UK has made some estimates. They anticipate, or they believe they spend about £15 million a year on their salt reduction program, which has dropped salt intake by about 10 to 15%. And if you model that out, that translates into about £1.5 billion a year in avoided healthcare costs and about 11,000 less deaths each year in the UK from strokes, heart attacks and the like. So potentially really, really, really cost effective. And it's sort of a tragedy that Australia and in fact most of the rest of the world isn't doing more about it.
If you could wave a magic wand and do something important and fast to get us on the right track with this. Yeah, what would you like to be able to do?
we've had a couple of government-led initiatives in Australia, and it's all around food supply. So that's the first thing to say. It's not about teaching people and educating people. This is about changing the environment. So it's about saying to the food industry, you will put 10% less salt in everything you manufacture.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if they did that, 10% less salt would be pretty much undetectable to most people, particularly if it went in every single food item. And if the government mandated it so that it happened in every food item, people wouldn't have to make any change to their behavior. They wouldn't have to change what they buy. No one would go out of business, and we would drop population-wide blood pressure by a couple of millimeters of mercury, and that would translate into thousands of strokes and heart attacks prevented every year. That is what I would do.
So why doesn't Big Food just do that?
Big Food doesn't do that because Big Food operates by competing with one another and not by collaborating. And there is a pretty strong argument that if you take salt out of your products and your competitors don't, then you will eventually lose market share because human palates have been adapted to seek out salt because they lived, you know, humans evolved for hundreds of thousands of years in a salt-poor environment.
Yep.
And so the palate is still attuned to seeking out salt. So if one company does it and the other one doesn't, they lose out. And food companies don't get together and do things like this because that's not what they do. They are competitors.
Yeah.
They only do it if government forces them to. And government does force them to do all sorts of things in the food space, but it's all around acute food poisoning.
Yes.
You know, so you have to refrigerate, you have to tin things in particular ways, you have to manufacture things in particular ways. So government's very happy to regulate and control the risks of acute food poisoning, but the massively greater risks of chronic food poisoning, they have showed, you know, little willingness to.
Is there any action afoot at the moment in terms of trying to persuade government otherwise?
So government had an initiative called the Food and Health Dialogue, which is a sort of public-private partnership with industry, which did act on salt levels in three or four food categories and did actually deliver upon some reductions. But that program was discontinued about, I think, probably nearly 3 years ago now, and replaced with something called the Healthy Food Partnership. The Healthy Food Partnership has been in place and had a series of meetings of different working groups, but to date, it's not clear to me that it's achieved anything in terms of further salt reduction. So there's a vehicle there, but it's glacial. It appears to have no teeth. We can hope that it's going to do something, but on current progress, it's not looking great.
That's a bit depressing. Is there a positive we can take from this?
Yeah, I think there are positives. I mean, in the broader food space, I guess if you look at sugar and sugar taxes, I'm not sure that if I, you know, put my public health hat on, I would necessarily go for sugar as the first option. I'd probably go for salt or saturated fat.
Mm-hmm.
But there are now many tens of jurisdictions around the world that are implementing taxes on sugar in sugary drinks or in a broader range of foods.
Yep.
And the community is right behind it. And we had a survey recently in Australia saying that, you know, great majority of Australians would be supportive of the sugar tax, particularly if it was hypothecated in some way such that the revenue was expended on, you know, health or schools or some such.
Yep.
So I think there is hope for broader food initiatives, but for salt in particular, there's not a great deal happening at the moment.
Is there a role for GPs in this particular area?
GPs can obviously provide advice, and they're the frontline mechanism of providing advice to the vast majority of people seeking healthcare in Australia.
Yep.
My fear is that the tools available to GPs to change what their patients eat are pretty limited. What GPs can do, and I would love them to keep talking to their patients about salt because, you know, like sugar, we need greater awareness of what the issues are. Government ultimately will only act on a sugar tax or programs for salt reduction if they feel that the community is behind them.
Yeah.
So I would be encouraging GPs to talk about this, but also encouraging GPs to not only tell their patients how they ought to be purchasing, but also that they ought to be getting behind initiatives for sort of broader reform of the food supply that focuses upon, you know, big food companies and regulation. You know, regulation is very un-PC. The nanny state gets a terrible name.
It does.
While it's perfectly acceptable for big business to do exactly the same thing, but because they can do it in the veil of free choice, which is actually nothing of the sort, they get away with it. Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks for your time, Bruce. My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.